Welcome to the after party. It's time to change. You're just getting started. You can teach an old dog new ways, and not just on Saturdays.
Hey, party people. It's Anna David with the After Party Pod. I'm sort of proud of myself that I have never said that before. Party people. Yeah. Anyway, this is the podcast all about addiction recovery, but we have fun. We're not earnest. If this was a website, which by the way, it is, I don't know if you're going to the accompanying website, but this website does not have rainbows and sunshine and hands up in the air. You know how all those rehabs, if you Google rehabs, which maybe you do, but if you Google image, it's always like hands up in the air, like to God and great. However, you know, that's wonderful. That's not me. I'm not into earnest, but I'm into real and honest. And yeah, I don't know how this intro has already devolved this way, but anyway, I'm good. Thanks for asking. Things are good. And, you know, the podcast is now every other week. I don't know. Do you guys like that? You have continued to send me. You know what? The emails have slowed down. I'm going to be honest. You have not continued to send me emails that are deeply meaningful to me and occasionally make me cry. But I know you're still listening because you're still downloading it. And this is not a plea. This is not go send me, go stop this right now and go send me an email telling me how much this means to you. But it is a... If you were thinking of sending an email and you thought, nah, I shouldn't, or what maybe I do sometimes get emails, which is adorable, that say, I don't know if you read your own email. Ugh. If only I could find one day be important enough to have somebody read my email. Oh, I did get a really nice email. This was a while back, but I'm not complaining. Oh my God, it was really, really nice. And, you know, I don't want to ever reveal too much about them, but a lovely girl who's been listening to the podcast and told me that she listens at night when she's falling asleep. And yeah, I mean, look, I'm not trying to sell you. You're already here. So anyway, it just means a lot when you tell me that you listen. Anyway, let's get to today's guest. Who receives a lot of email about, I know this. I haven't even seen it, but I know it for sure. He is a great guy. He is a controversial guy, I would say, in recovery circles. His name is Mishka Shubali. Great name, great guy. I met him because, well, here's who he is. He's a writer and a musician, and he has an MFA from Columbia and all that, but who cares? There's lots of people who have those, am I right? But not all of them are best-selling authors. He is the most successful Kindle singles author that exists. Now, Kindle singles, for the uninitiated, are books that Amazon hires people directly to write. So it's a book deal. You're not just uploading a book to Amazon. You have actually been assigned this by Amazon. They have told you that they want you to write, and they're short. They're 20 to 30 pages. They sell for $1.99 or $2.99 or whatever it is in the special Kindle single section of Amazon. And I've actually done two. I'm not hyping my own, but I did one called Animal Attraction and one called They Like Me, They Really Like Me. Neither of which were as close to as successful as Mishka Shubali's. He has done, how many has he done? I mean, more than anybody else. One, two, three. I should have known the number before I started. But his big one was The Long Run, which is about how he writes a lot about, you know, alcoholism, drinking, partying, the whole thing. And he got sober and became an obsessive, I hope he doesn't mind my saying that, long distance runner, and, you know, is in all those impressive races I don't even know the names of, but, you know, anyway, and he defines sobriety differently than a lot of people. He doesn't, you know, taking mushrooms is all part of it. He is not a 12-step guy, though he is unlike many who are not 12-step people. absolutely understands that it helps people. He recommends that people go there. He is also a musician, and he has records called How to Make a Bad Situation Worse and Thanks for Letting Me Crash. He plays in the band Fresh Kills. Not the Fresh Kills, Fresh Kills. And he's now doing his full-length book. And he is, I mean, Google him. Google image him if you haven't. He's the best looking guest we've had, and I'm not shallow, and we've had a lot of attractive guests, so, you know, whatever. I'm a professional above all else at times anyway. So you can find out everything about him at his website, which I'm going to spell his name because it's not a name you've heard before, unless you know him. You've never heard this name before. Mishka Shubali, MISHKASHUBALY. MishkaShubali.com. Here he is.
I first started taking drugs by chewing blocks of hash.
Oh my God. I think my copy has like blood stains on it from shooting up while reading it.
Party animal. I hate to say that because that makes me sound Paris Hilton-y. I was on the, as right. I call it, the Autobahn to nowhere.
I'm very lucky because would you have wanted to have a celebrity junkie for a dad?
You realize these crackers are fucking they're like $100 a cracker. Do you want one? They're not. It's from Whole Foods. I think you need to try one. It's really great to chew into a microphone.
I feel like this is a very California cracker. This is not like a saltine. We are not putting on the Ritz with these.
We are not putting on the Ritz with these.
They look. It just looks like it's made out of tree bark.
It kind of is. I mean, you'll hate it, but it's super healthy.
It'll align my chakras.
It might. And, it might. Just be. Has being in LA aligned any of your chakras?
Oh, man. Not so far.
Wait an hour after this. This could have been it.
All right. We'll see.
Okay. I'm going to totally. This is all. I'm just talking for the very beginning because you have so too much to say for me to interrupt. But speaking of chakras, the reason I'm late, it's the worst reason in the world. I was getting a psychic reading.
Oh, man. I'm just going to interview you now.
Oh, my God. It was... That's not the weird part. Okay, so I was supposed to do this story for this unnamed publication. And they said, do a story about the best psychics in LA. I spent, like... I'm not kidding. 10 hours of work trying to find this stuff out. They were like, do this, don't do it, whatever. And then they canceled the story on Friday.
I fucking love freelance writing. It's just... when you're a freelance writer, you spend the bulk of your time...
Chasing
a job, yeah. And then fighting to get paid afterwards,
yeah,
is bullshit. Yeah. I read something the other day that there's in the freelance writing market, there's $13 million up for grabs
for everybody. Are you saying that's a lot or a little?
How many freelance writers do you know? We know like a shitload. Yeah. $13 million. That's nothing.
Yeah, you know what though? It's sort of like statistics about sobriety. Look how I turned it around. Really? How are they going to get all that? How are they going to get that figure? They don't know what I pay my freelancers. There are a million random websites like mine. You know what I mean?
When I have to start like really digging into doing freelance writing, I'm just going to do like the on-demand porn stories where it's like, okay, it takes place in a library. The woman has red hair. Go.
Well, what do you mean? What is an on-demand porn story? Like that's a real living you can make?
Well, it was probably 10 or 15 years ago now. I remember reading that some writer who I'm blanking on, you know,
Jerry Stahl. Was it Jerry Stahl?
I don't think so. I think it was further back than
okay,
that.
Okay.
But that, you know, he made, you know, the way that he financed, you know, living and surviving while he was writing novels was writing these sort of like, you know, specifically set, you know, like erotic stories.
Right.
For people who would request, you know, okay, you know, there's... you know, there's, you know,
gangbang.
It would be like two sisters in Connecticut and a Volvo. Or, I don't know why. like
the least erotic car imaginable.
New Yorkers, boring erotic stories.
Yeah, exactly. Wait, I have heard of that. So, freelance writing. Oh, by the way, they were paying me $15.
But I was so this into it because I was getting free psychic readings, so I was like,
yeah, you know? Yeah.
But anyway, I already had an appointment, so I went. You know, I was like, oh, I already made it. I walk in, and it's, okay, I go to an exercise thing that's like 9 people in the world go to. It's called GST. No one's ever heard of it. I can't describe it. It's amazing. I knew him from GST. Like, we worked out together yesterday.
Weird. Okay, that's really interesting.
He was the psychic.
Did he gaze into the crystal ball and say, you're working in a field where you're chronically underpaid?
No, he told me that I was going to be like the next Marianne Williamson. I don't know. It's weird that there's a Marianne Williamson quote above here, but I don't know that I see that. But he also thought, he's like, oh, your website, it's about film. I'm like, you're not good at this, are you? And I didn't like a lot of the stuff he told me, so...
Yeah.
It's hard to know, was he not telling me what I didn't want to hear, or is he a bad psychic? They feel the same to me.
My official stance on that stuff is that it's a bunch of crap.
Yeah, I'm not surprised you think that.
But there's a unofficially, there's been a lot of stuff that's happened in my life that I, like, can't really explain. And I just try not to think about it because it doesn't conform to my cynical worldview.
But, like, things that you have been told or things that are inexplicable just as they happen?
Things that have happened to me firsthand, you know, where I'm like, well, there's no rational explanation for why this has happened.
Okay, well, now you have to tell me.
Are we already going to get into...
No, we're not.
I'm already steering us in a very L.A. crystal waving...
Perfect.
...patchouli... incense burning direction. And that's the last thing I want to do. I want to bring the like New York hate, the bitterness,
I don't think you can help but bring that. So no worries. But we did point out that your chakras might be aligned by the end of this. Come on. That's great. This is great. I would never think I would get from you your bizarre, unexplained coincidences or whatever you're going to tell me.
I always fight with Rich Roll about this stuff.
Oh, you do?
I love arguing with Rich about this stuff, and I love Rich.
I know.
And he's an amazing dude. But every time I talk to him, he's like, you know, Mishka, you just need to, you know, like raise the level of your vibration. And I'm like, Rich, I love you, and I'm going to strangle you because you're fucking killing me with this.
Yeah.
I love being proved wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you get proved wrong, you're learning something.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I value the experiences that I've had that don't conform to my overall worldview. In 2001, my friend Jacob died.
Mm-hmm.
And it sucked. And we knew a woman, Vicky, in St. John, who... had known Jacob and known his family, and like she's a little like sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
She knew that he had died before word had gotten out that he had died.
Mm-hmm.
And then later that year I went down there and she does Rolfing or
mm-hmm.
yeah of course you know what that is.
Yeah.
We're in LA.
I was about
to give you a footnote and you're in, yeah, all right.
There are people outside of LA who listen to this podcast, so it's deeply intense, massaged-ish, that brings out feelings. Is that the way you describe it?
The way that it was described to me was structural integration, just making your body line up. Maybe they left out the emotional part when describing it to me because they knew that I would But I love Vicky and, you know, totally trust her and sort of, you know, hold her in the highest esteem. You know, she's been a friend of our family for a long time. And I was, you know, in 2001, I was, you know, particularly troubled with the loss of my friend. And also, you know, drinking a ton.
Yeah.
So in exchange for, like, doing some painting around her apartment, she, you know, she did, like, a session with me. And at one point... I was lying there on my side with my eyes closed, and suddenly, instead of seeing, like, my own body, I saw Jacob's body,
mm-hmm.
you know, where, and it freaked me out a little bit, and then I was like, no, nothing bad's gonna happen, it's Jacob, you know, like, So I was like, well, let's just see how far, just go into it. How far does this go? And so I just sort of like started at my feet that were his feet. And I could see sort of like, in my mind, just sort of like taking an inventory of my body or whatever. Mm-hmm. I could see his body. And it was a little weird. And then Vicky said, all right, Jacob, can you roll over?
But she knew him and knew he had died.
She knew him and she knew he had died.
Right.
And she knew that he and I were friends. Did she know what was happening to me at that moment?
Right, well, she did, but you hadn't told her.
Yeah, and then I, like, opened my eyes and looked at her, and she was sort of, like, smiled, and she was like, it's okay. And I was like, okay, I trust her. She said it's okay. And then I, like, rolled over my other side, closed my eyes, and I was like, can I go back into this? And I went right back into it. I can't explain that.
What?
I want to explain it in a very rational, it's a projection or wish fulfillment or something like that. Or I missed my friend. I wanted to feel close to him. I was with somebody I trusted. I allowed myself to. But that at that very moment that I was sort of detecting him in my body, that she then called me by his name.
Well, but also detecting him in your body alone is a truly bizarre.
Yeah, that's never happened to me before or since. And I had a bunch of experiences like that with him after he died where...
The same thing with him in your body?
Our lives were sort of conflated. Mm-hmm. He came to me in a dream and, and I was like, dude, like, oh my God. So, this was like maybe a week or 10 days after his death. I was like, so good to see you. Like, why is it taking you so long to like come and see me? And he was like, well... I did have obligations of the familial variety, if you understand. And I was like, and he always spoke like that. Like,
Right. Why
speak in a fluid, natural manner when you can speak in the most ostentatious, erratic.
Right. Non-colloquial.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, all right, fuck you, dude. Okay, I understand what you're saying. And, he had a new shirt and I was like, man, is that a new shirt? Like, you look sharp. And he was like, oh, they give us a small stipend here for clothing. Which was, again, that's his sense of humor, not mine.
Right.
And he was like cracking jokes with me. And then I was like, I have great news. I'm going to finish your thesis so you can graduate posthumously. And he was like, well, this is terrible news. I can think of no worse person to finish my thesis than you. And I was like, well, no, dude, I'm not going to do it in my voice as me. I'm going to, just lightly edit your work and turn it in. And then he was like, really, really got into it and was like, okay, you need to do this and you need to do that. And like, you need to talk to this person. And he wanted me to talk to his ex-girlfriend. And then I was like, wait. I'm not giving you my life.
Right.
I'm just going to finish the
thesis. 2 weeks of work, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then he looked a little dismayed and he was like, okay, all right. We'll do the thesis thing. And then, yeah, he like gave me like, all these directions and stuff. And I sort of like woke up and I was like,
did you do it? You didn't finish his thesis.
Yeah, I...
You did.
And once I was working in the computer lab, at Columbia, with whatever, 35 other kids, around me, and I was working on his thesis, and there was one line that was, like, so awkward and so... just had no flow to it whatsoever. And I was like, I know this is how he wrote and this is how he wanted it, but I'm just gonna like let myself neaten this up just so that it scans a little better. And I deleted what he had written, went in to retype it, and the keyboard just typed letters that didn't...
Pretentious.
No, it typed out letters that didn't correspond to was typing.
Oh my God.
And I was like, okay, I just have my hands in the wrong place. So I went, like, backed up, deleted what I had just written, made sure that my hands and fingers were in the right place, and then started typing again, and it happened again.
Words that he would use, or gibberish?
No. Gibberish. And also, you hit the G key, and a V comes up. And you hit the S key, and an H comes up. What I was typing did not correspond to what was showing up on the screen. And it was more alarming to me that there were 30 other people around me while this was happening than it would have been had I been on my own.
You wouldn't have believed it?
Yeah. If I had been on my own, it would have been easy to say, like, oh, you just, you know, too much coffee or too hungover or whatever. But I was in public. There were other people there, and it fucking freaked me out. So I saved the stuff, just, like, walked away. And then I came back a day later, restored what I had changed, and and never had that problem again.
That is so bizarre. But did you turn it in, and did it...
He graduated posthumously or whatever? I turned it in, and he graduated posthumously, yeah.
Oh, that's... Okay. So, okay, the interesting thing about that in you is that, you know, you are sort of decidedly, is it fair to say, non-spiritual?
I think that is that's accurate. I'm not, you know, I know so many people who say, like, oh, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. I'm not spiritual. I'm not religious. I think I believe in the physical world. I believe what we, you know, in what we see and what we can touch. And I don't believe in, you know, somebody gave me, a friend of mine gave me a keychain that says vibes, which is just to fuck with me.
Right.
Because that's not my, you know, it's not my thing at all. But, you know, also, like, you know, my mom used to say all the time when I was a kid, you know, just put a smile on your face and you'll feel better. And I was like, Mom, that's bullshit. Like, what do you know? You know? No, it's totally true. If you smile, and it's, like, proven in laboratories by scientists in white coats, if you smile, your body will respond and you'll feel happier.
Yeah.
You know, oh, meditation. Oh, it's such garbage, such crap. You know, I was, like, you know, bickering with Rich about that. I tried it one day. Oh, yeah, it's totally worked for me. And then, you know, and then I looked it up. Oh, yeah, totally real, scientifically proven.
Yeah.
Meditation is real.
Yeah.
And, you know, it does have a profound effect on your brain function. I'm skeptical, but I'm not dogmatic. You know, I mean, if somebody proves me wrong, like, I've been proved wrong, you know, and let's, like, move forward from there. I do think that, you know, I mean, there's a lot of concepts that are just accepted as, you know, accepted as true or, universally applicable or something like that. You know, this concept of a soulmate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in my experience, most oftentimes that I've encountered that word, it's when a woman is in a terrible relationship and she's using it as a reason for not leaving the guy who's treating her like garbage. That to me, for the outcome of that, women allowing themselves to be treated horribly.
Yeah.
If you backtrack from there, that proves to me that the concept of soulmate is garbage. You know, and we need to, like, enter into a relationship as rational people that, like, you know, 80% of you I love. The other 20% drives me nuts.
Right.
And I'm just going to have to, like...
deal with that. Somehow find a way to
accept
that.
Let it ride or ignore it or, you know, accept it. And also understand that our relationship is going to work not because of some divine hand, but because of what you and I put into it.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I really, you know, people are saying, oh, you don't believe in God, you know, how can you be ethical? You know, well, there, you know, there's my religious mantra, you know, the tattoo that says be good. You know, I mean, if you live in a godless world, then in a world that's just chaos, I think there's more responsibility on human beings to create good in the world.
Right.
You know, than to see ourselves as puppets or something. I've really had a lot of coffee.
It's great. I don't even have to ask questions. But, I mean, people actually say, if you don't believe in God, how can you be ethical? I mean, that seems ludicrous to me.
Yeah, but you're smarter than the average bear.
So true. Let's talk about that. So you go around and you talk to idiots about spirituality, is what you're telling me. No, they're not idiots. They're people who are very dogmatic.
Online commenters.
Oh, Jesus.
Which are, you know, the worst of the worst.
You don't read those. You read those?
Oh, are you kidding?
You read everyone.
Oh, man. Well, this is the thing, is that you know, people say, oh, why do you do that? Why do you torture yourself? Every once in a while, man, I'll read something that somebody's written and it's hilarious.
Yeah.
Or it's really insightful.
Yeah.
Or they're trying to attack me in a way that I find, you know, hilarious. I don't read all the reviews on my stories and stuff like that. But, you know, when people write to me, I read every single thing that people write to me. And, you know,
people email you negative shit?
Yeah. Not, I mean, it's overwhelmingly positive, but a lot of people, you know, will call me out on my position with AA, my position on mushrooms, my addiction to running.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
But, you know, and, you know, these are sort of old things for me. But yeah, I get that shit all the time. And I welcome it, you know. I mean, I believe that, you know, dialogue is the way for everybody, you know, everybody to move forward. And if you just stick with your, your liberal left wing, you know, vegan buddies, you're not doing any good.
Right.
You should be, you know, John Joseph said, you know, he's like, you know, I'm not going to go to veg fest or whatever. He's like, I want to talk to the guy at McDonald's.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's the proving ground right there.
Yeah, I mean, to count internet commenters, anonymous internet commenters, as people, dialogue with is generous, I would say.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. I mean, man, the internet really just brings the worst out in everybody.
It does. I don't read most of the shit, but I read the reviews of this podcast.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I will. And I have gotten such helpful feedback from those assholes. Like, most of the reviews are so nice. But, you know, there are people who are like, she says right too much. And she talks about herself too much. And, like, things that I've taken to heart and incorporated.
Yeah.
But it took a long time to get there, I think.
That's why I don't have my mother read my work.
Yeah.
When I'm trying to, get it done, get it, make it good. I give it to her and she's like, oh, I love it. It's brilliant. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mom, no, that doesn't help me at all. Tell me what sucks. Well, no, I just think it's so great. All right, Mom, you're fired.
Right.
You know, I need to find, you know, so it's, I try and find that, you know, people who are, my friend Zach has a finely tuned ear for sexual bias. And, sharper than a lot of women I know, or maybe just more outspoken about it, or maybe we've just been friends for such a long time that he feels very comfortable being like, Michigan, you jerk, you have to change that.
Right.
So, you know, he's an invaluable reader because he has no qualms about hurting my feelings or, you know, the agent that I have right now, the first time that I met him, he sat down and just hurt my feelings. And I was like, okay, you're the dude. Because I don't need somebody to pat my head, you know. I need somebody to say, this needs to be better here.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
And someone, you know, and also when, you know, when you meet those people who are comfortable giving you hard information or unpleasant information, you know they're being straight with you.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to someone who's like, you know, oh, no, honey, you look fine.
Yeah, it's funny. I want that. I want the like rose-colored glasses or whatever, or the codependent, whatever you want to call it. Unless it comes to writing, unless it comes to feedback for writing, because somehow I just don't. From people trying to help me, I do not take it personally. I don't know. Yeah. It took a while. But wait, let's talk about your writing. Okay, so basically, you at Columbia, you met David Blum. Is this? I want to talk about the career writing and how, and we got to get into the drinking and the drinking was and all that stuff.
We're like going to have to talk incredibly quickly because we have a lot to work through.
A lot. Let's do gibberish. Let's do peanuts. but I like talking about them side by side.
Okay. Should we start with where I met David Blum?
Let's start with when you started writing because it was way before that.
I started writing when I was like 6.
Wow.
My mom wanted to be a writer. And so, and she was, you know, she wanted the two things she wanted to do in her life. She wanted to be a writer and she wanted to be a mom. Mm-hmm. And so when we were kids, we had access to tons and tons of books, and she was always reading to us, and everything was, you know, sort of narrative and story and, you know, playing games, you know, that involved story and imagination and stuff like that. And she has stuff that, you know, stories that I told her that sort of that she wrote down. And then I think the first time I recall being embarrassed about my writing is in sixth grade. I wrote a story and the teacher stood up and read it in front of the class and cried. And I was like, oh God, this is terrible. But yeah, so I mean, I think I was always gifted at writing, and that's, you know, that's what I came out of, you know, a narrative tradition, you know, jokes and narrative songs and, narrative games and books, you know. Mm-hmm. And when I discovered guitar and then cigarettes and alcohol, I tried to jettison that. Mm-hmm. In favor of following my spirit animal Slash from Guns N' Roses, and I failed to do that.
Still time.
Yeah. It, man, being in LA, I'm just like, Slash, I can feel you. I can feel your vibes.
Slash?
Yeah.
You can? So, okay. So you knew that you could write, but you were writing music in your quest to become Slash?
Yeah. I knew that I would never be a shredder. So when I was like 13 or something, I started writing songs. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, terrible, you know, power ballads and stuff. I'm so glad that there was no garage band.
No one heard them. Yeah.
And then I guess I started to get serious about writing when I was in undergrad.
Mm-hmm. And that was at Columbia.
No, undergrad was University of Colorado.
Okay.
Which is probably the worst place in the world for me.
For an alcoholic to be.
Well, I mean, the defining elements of the student population at CU are, you know, the sports program, because it's a huge, you know, state mm-hmm. university, the, like, wealthy out-of-state students, and hippies. Mm-hmm. And those are, like, three elements that I loathe. I hate sports.
You are a major athlete. You just hate sports.
I'm not a major athlete. I run. But I think running is more like active therapy, or I'm not competing against anyone else. I don't. For me, there is no finish line. Mm-hmm. It's more like a meditative practice.
Jesus, you are.
I know.
So hard, and it's not. I mean, I wonder if this will be your lifelong quest.
I'm losing this battle to not become a hippie.
You are in LA. So we'll take this as a potentially isolated incident.
I'm moving here.
Are you?
Yeah.
Smart.
I know.
It's so much better.
Yeah. I mean, last night was miserable. We had a terrible night last night.
I'm so glad I didn't go.
Douchebag promoter ripped us off. But my whole family lives in California now. I'm getting kicked out of my apartment. I hate, you know, I feel like opening a vein every winter in New York.
Yeah.
But anyway, so yeah, I was at the University of Colorado, and I wanted, you know, all my friends were going to film school. So I was like, I want to go to film school too, because I had no idea what I wanted to do with myself. But all the film classes happened at night, and I had to work at Sonic Burger.
Okay.
To pay my way. Mm-hmm. And so the only classes that I could take were the writing classes during the day. And then I took writing classes, and I did well and got, you know, good feedback from my my professors, and I loved it, you know. And then you know, after I got my undergrad degree, I did nothing, and my drinking got worse and worse. And so I moved to New York, and I said, I'm going to apply to one graduate school, and then if I don't get in, I'll go to rehab.
So let's talk about your drinking. When did you start drinking?
Probably 13.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
do you remember your first drink?
I don't remember my first drink because, you know, we were always like, you know, having a sip of our dad's beer or mm-hmm. like, you know, a sip of wine or something like that. But I remember my first drunk, and it was, you know, like a whatever six pack of Bud Tall Boys, you know, out by the railroad tracks.
Alone or with people?
With my sister's ex-boyfriend and a couple other, you know, a couple of other people. And I just remember, like, man, like the feel of a freezing cold 16-ounce beer in your hand. And I was just like, you know, I feel like a man, you mm-hmm. know. And then when I was, you know, I was getting drunk, I was like, this is just phenomenal. Like, yeah. This is who I'm going to be. You know, this is what I'll do. And fuck everything else. You know, I'm going to do this all the time.
Yeah.
And I did.
Yeah. Yeah. And so did you just stick with, you didn't stick with just drinking beer, but so you, high school, college, you're drinking in Colorado.
I left high school after 2 years. And so when I was 15, I started a college program. Mm-hmm. By that point, I was already, like, you know, drinking vodka or whatever. And then when I went away to Simon's Rock, you know, no parental supervision. So, you know, drinking, you know, dropping acid, drinking cough syrup, mm-hmm. you know, things got really out of control, like, pretty quickly.
How does the transition go from drinking alcohol to drinking cough syrup?
Well, the motion is the same.
One day, did someone say to you, was it you open your medicine cabinet and you're like, I bet this would be good?
No, it was sort of like a, you know, a common lore in the school that if you, you know, drank this dosage of this type of cough syrup, that you would, you know, you would sort of trip. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I tried it, and we tried it, and it was amazing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's what we did for a long time. To this day, if somebody has, like, a cherry cough drop in their mouth, it makes me start to dry heave because I threw up from drinking cough syrup so often. Yeah, it's a terrible thing.
That's, like, for me, I see a mirror, or, you know, on the table, or even a CD case, which luckily you don't see that much anymore, and I immediately, first I go to excitement about cocaine, and then I go to depression.
Like, yeah, wow, just like that. It's yeah. Like, it's like you can have all the effects of cocaine without cocaine.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
That's a neat trick.
Yeah, I mean, it all happens in a millisecond, so I don't know that it's lasting. But by the way, speaking of what we're talking about, the psychic I just went to, I'm not sure how good he was or what he was talking about half the time, but we were talking about coke, and I mean, how I used to do it. He was like, cocaine was God to you. You get that, right? And I'm like, well, you know, I get it. Like, in recovery, people will often say, and I do believe it, that, like, people, oftentimes alcoholics were actually seeking God or seeking a spiritual solution and didn't know how to find it, so found this shortcut that, you know, that obviously didn't work. And so, you know, and anyway, it's like I've never talked this much about spirituality on the podcast, and it's like I'm trying to convert you or see how far I can get, but the world is clearly trying to convert you. So anyway,
the universe.
So God is trying to convert you. So you drinking cough syrup, taking, tripping, and that was your priority.
I mean, I you know, at heart, I'm a good boy, and I love my mom, mm-hmm. and I always, you know, tried hard to be good, to be a good boy, and mm-hmm. to, like, not get in trouble, and to not act out in class, and not be an idiot, and mm-hmm. it was impossible for me.
Why do you think that is, that it was impossible?
Partially because, you know, partially because I just had behavior issues, you know, as a kid, and I think I was angry at my father, and, like, you know, we moved a lot and I'd gotten picked on a lot, and also partially because fucking high school is bullshit, man. And, you know, I mean, I remember, like, being grilled by one of my teachers, you know, who was like, you know, my science teacher, oh, you think you're such hot shit, you know, like, you're really not. And, you know, and I was like, oh yeah, you know, did you ace this course when you were my age? No, you didn't. And that's why you're a teacher and not, right. and not a fucking scientist. So don't bust my balls.
Right.
Can you imagine having me in class? I was this big when I was like 14.
Right.
It must have been a fucking nightmare for
yeah.
my teachers.
But I mean, true. I mean, nobody, you're not allowed to say that shit,
yeah.
obviously.
Yeah.
And I don't think most, I didn't know that in high school. I think I still thought my teachers, they were idiots. I'm sorry. My high school had the worst teachers ever. And it's renowned for being amazing. I'm just going to say that. An unnamed high school that I've written about extensively in my business, but whatever, Google. But you were only in high school for 2 years?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we moved from Los Alamos, New Mexico, where, you know, it's a community built around the National Laboratory where almost everybody, you know, almost every family is, you know, one or two rocket scientist parents, you know, so the, like the public school was amazing, you know, mm-hmm. very valued intellectualism, mm-hmm. you know. And then we moved to New Hampshire, the whitest state in the union, mm-hmm. the poorest school district in New Hampshire. And it was just boring and bureaucracy and you know, I wasn't popular. And
even though you were the big kid, you were this big?
Yeah, well, I didn't, there's a certain sort of stripe of males who always want to fight the big guy.
Okay. Know?
So when I left high school, I was on the verge of getting expelled for fighting, mm-hmm. You know, because I had an attitude problem and just like wouldn't let myself be pushed around. I finally sort of figured out how to fight back and to fight back. But yeah, it was a miserable experience. I couldn't wait to get out of there. And then going to Simon's Rock was just like awesome because, you know, we were treated like, you know, adults in training.
Right.
You know, not like second class citizens or something like that.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And the quality of the education there was top notch.
So, okay. So how much of this attitude problem and all of that is related, do you think, to drinking?
I think that I sought out drinking as a cure for my depression and my anger and my insecurity and my self-loathing and stuff like that. And of course it was, you know, sort of the worst, most hopeless cure ever because right. it just perpetuated all those issues.
Yeah.
But I didn't become an insecure, angry guy from drinking. I drank because I was an insecure, angry guy.
Yeah.
You know. And I think a lot of that has to do with my father, you know. Guys like me, the bad tattoos and daddy issues.
Yeah.
Dime a dozen, Anna.
Well, the tattoos a little bit are a result of the daddy issues.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, so,
I really need to get the tattoo that just says, please ask me about my parents' divorce.
I used to have this theory that every time I saw a tattoo that the person was saying to me, I'm scared.
Hmm.
That was what they were communicating to me. I don't know about that theory. I had 4. I got them removed.
Wow, really?
I had the theory years after the removal of the tattoos. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. But, okay, but I want to get to when the wheels fell off the bus.
Yeah.
So, you're drinking, you're living in New York, you are a musician.
Yeah.
You're in grad school?
Yeah. I moved to New York with $300 when I was 21 mm-hmm. in 1998. Mm-hmm. And joined a band.
Mm-hmm. And you play?
I play bass and I play
mm-hmm.
guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got into Columbia. And mm-hmm. so I was like trying to, you know, play in this band. And, you know, it was my dream that we were going to make it big. And, but then also doing graduate school, which, you know, everybody in graduate school was like, what the fuck are you doing playing in this band, man? And I was like, you have no idea what this means to me.
Yeah.
But you know, this is the thing though, is that, for better and for worse, I was really good at holding it down
yeah.
when I was shit-faced. I mean, I was, you know, I remember like locking myself in the bathroom with like DTs sometimes and then like, you know, getting my shit together and like going to class or writing the paper or, you know, and like, you know, turning the stuff, you know, getting my paper in on, you know, my papers in on time, not missing class, you know, mm-hmm. and like, and, you know, that was, I think that's why I was able to You know, I was like the train wreck that never completely went off the tracks.
Right.
You know, just sort of like falling apart and still moving forward. You know, the Walking Dead, you know.
Did people know?
Yeah. It was, I mean, it was pretty obvious. I remember being at some, you know, some party, and I think I was like blacked out on the, you know, on the couch or on the floor or something. And then I like sort of like got up and was like stumbling somewhere, and this girl had, you know, was in conversation to one with one of my friends, and then she whipped her head over and looked at me and she said, "You got into Columbia?"
Right.
And I said, "Does that make it better or make it worse?" And she looked at me and she said, "Worse."
Were you like, "Bitch, I also graduated from high school in 2 years. So, you fucking chill out."
Well, I always thought that that stuff was just a fluke. I was like, oh, well, any, no matter how good the net is, somebody's got to slip through. I just slipped through.
And, wow. Interesting, yeah. Interesting theory. So, okay, and so were you doing, you were mostly a drinker, am I right? Not
yeah.
really a drug guy.
Yeah, alcohol was always my my poison of choice. Mm-hmm. You know, and I really like, really only ever did coke just so I could drink more,
mm-hmm.
you know, because mm-hmm. I was too fucked up. And like, I, you know, I would do coke just so I could.
And the DTs, when you say, so you would have just, you do it up and then you decide to take a break, or that was before you drank that day, or how would that happen?
I would have like night terrors and panic attacks. And also I was drinking to the point where I, like, just weird things would happen with my body, where I would wake up and my hands were like frozen into claws.
Mm-hmm.
Or my hands and my feet and my mouth all swelled up one day.
What is that a sign of? I mean,
I don't know.
You didn't, and you obviously didn't go to the doctor to try to find out. Yeah.
You know, and one time I like, you know, broke a bottle with my hand, and then like woke up the next day and like just, you know, my bed was covered in blood, and mm-hmm. I had to go on like $5,000 worth of like reconstructive surgery.
Ah, so it was all over your body?
To put it back together and like,
mm.
yeah. And I just thought that was my life.
Yeah.
That was how it was going to be. And, you know, stiff upper lip and like just, you just get, you know, get through it.
And then what changed? What made you decide to change?
I was 32.
Mm-hmm.
And it's taken me a long time to realize what the...
emphasis?
The pivotal moment was.
Yeah.
But I was writing a song about my funeral. And my ex coming to the funeral, and who her plus one was going to be for my funeral, like which guy, you know,
right.
who her new boyfriend was that she was going to bring to my funeral. And when I was 20, I drank for 3 or 4 days and then woke up and I was having this crazy hallucination of this like underwater garden with, you know, sort of like coral and fish and like, you know, sort of beckoning me in. And I sort of, it was a beautiful vision, but I understood that if I went too deeply into it, I would die. You mm-hmm. know, that I would just be like lured in and then drown.
Mm-hmm.
And it scared the shit out of me. And, you know, that was when I was 20.
Yeah.
You know, 12 years later, I had the epiphany that, you know, so I wrote in this song, I said, I've seen the underwater garden and I'm not afraid to die. As much as I'm afraid to feel like dying every day for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I realized at 32, you know, at 20, I thought that that alcohol would kill me. And at 32, I realized that my fate was way worse, that alcohol would never kill me.
Right.
It would just give me a life that was so degraded that death would seem like a release.
Right.
And it would just be a living hell. And I just had the epiphany that I was like, this is bigger than I am. I can't win this fight. You know, this will crush me. This will destroy me. And I, you know, to realize that I was more afraid of life than I was of death. I was like, I gotta fucking change everything. You know, I just need to, like, pull the emergency brake and start over.
I wonder how much that is a common experience that people are not conscious of. I mean, I relate to that a lot, you know. And I had a very similar thing. I never talk about this, but I went in to, like, have blood drawn. This was, I think, a week before I got sober. And I put my arms down for them to draw the blood. And my thought was, God, it's so good. I don't have track marks. That would be so embarrassing. I'd never shot drugs in my life. I had done heroin. And it was like this sudden, it was like the universe split. And I saw some crazy vision of what my life was going towards. Mm-hmm. And I got sober a week later.
It's funny. I went to the free STD clinic mm-hmm. a couple of weeks after I got sober. And I got checked out, and they have you answering all the, drug and alcohol, history and sexual partners and all that stuff. And there's this, lengthy question after question after question after question. I wasn't feeling particularly well that day either.
Yeah.
And after going through the whole thing, and this is like doctor talking to me about what I had, I'm not a doctor, but I knew the answers that I was giving her and the answers that she wanted to hear were two very different things,
Yeah.
And, so she sort of detailed my behavior, and the risks that I was creating for myself and for other people. And then she said, I just have two more questions for you. What is it exactly that you're going to do with your life? And what is your fucking problem? And I feel like I should buy that doctor a pony. Because I really, I had so many people helping me and looking out for me for so long. Never help a drunk. Never help them. For the people who bought me breakfast or bought me lunch or paid my parking tickets or, like, helped me find a lawyer or whatever, all that did was just extend my drinking career.
Yeah.
And what helped was when my friends were finally like, dude, I can't hang out with you anymore.
Right.
Like, it's too depressing to watch.
Right.
And when my oldest inner circle friends started sort of like, retreating, that scared the shit out of me, man. That was, there was nothing I feared more than being alone.
Right. Even though drinking is the most isolating, drinking like that is the most isolating thing you can do.
Oh, no way, man. When I was drinking, I was hanging out with my best buddy, the unconditional lover.
Right.
The listening voice.
Right.
It was just like me and my best friend, you know?
Okay, so you said to yourself, I'm not going to do that AA. I'm not going to do the 12 step.
Yeah, I knew that. I just knew that it wasn't for me. Mm-hmm. I knew that I couldn't do it.
And so how much willpower was involved, is involved?
Well, Anna, I'm going to come clean to you and tell you that I'm a pretty hard-headed guy.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know this about me.
I know
this. But I'm a pretty headstrong dude.
So you just made a decision and that was that?
Yeah, it takes me a long time to come to a decision. I recognized when I was 17 that I was an alcoholic. But I knew, even then, I knew people who were like flip-flopping, like, oh, I gotta quit. Oh, I'm gonna just have one beer. Oh, no, I'm quitting for real. This like hell of just like trying to quit and failing and trying to quit and failing and trying to quit and failing. And for some reason, it sounds like a crazy thing to say is a good thought, but for me, it was a good thought. I realized I'm just going to drink until I can't drink anymore.
Right.
And then I'm never going to drink again. I'm just going to I'm going to run it out. I'm going to burn this urge out. And, you know, by the time I was finally ready to quit when I was 32, I hadn't had a good drink in a long time. You know, right. I was just having the same bad drink and the same bad drunk over and right. over again. So when I quit, you know, the vault doors closed and it was just like, none shall pass, mm-hmm. you know, nothing will get through this. And I was challenged, you know, early and often. I mean, you know, 2 months after I got sober, I got a job working in a bar.
Right.
And then, you know, a couple of nights I like grabbed the wrong, you know, cup at the door. And instead of getting like my Diet Coke, I got a big mouthful of rum and Coke or something yeah. like that, you know? And that's a great opportunity to be like, well, I already cheated, so, you know, shots, you know?
Yeah, but I mean, that's beyond bullshit. I mean,
absolutely. And I didn't, and I never yeah. did. Or, you know, you meet all sorts of interesting people in bars, you know? So I met some, you know, girls who were like, you know, well, what if I take this vodka in my mouth and then kiss you? And then and I would be like, well, that's when I call you a taxi.
right. But you've made out with girls who have been drinking.
Yeah, yeah. I
secretly love it. Not the girls. I don't do that. But yeah, no, I do. And I don't think that's so bad.
Yeah, this is the thing, man, is that, I mean, listen, whatever works. I know that my process, you know, doesn't work for everyone and wouldn't work for everyone. But one of the things that was great for me about working in a bar right away is that there was no illusion that there was a barrier between me and alcohol.
Right.
You know, if I want a drink on a Sunday, it's fucking, and I can't get into a bar, Scope, Listerine,
right.
you know, hand sanitizer, rubbing alcohol. If I want a drink, I'm going to take a drink.
Yeah.
What I need is the clarity in my head that there's nothing that can happen in this world that will make me take a drink. I just needed to get just that thing. Nothing can make me drink. Yeah, I mean, you know, to kiss a girl I'm attracted to who has like wine on her breath or like, you know, vodka cranberry. That was like the, you know, a good morning drink to sort of like get things rolling, you know? you know, it sort of like, you know, fond memory or nostalgic or whatever, but I have a great memory and I remember every hangover. I remember like throwing up blood in public on the street, you know, or just like laying on the floor of my bathroom, like unable to get up, or like, you know, throwing up on myself and like throwing up through my nose. You know, I mean, and you know, every time I would think, oh man, wow, that Jameson smells so good. I would just be like, remember. Just remember that hangover. Remember that. You remember crawling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in front of people. Just crawling. And I would force myself to remember that. And then, so now there's no...
And now it's automatic that you remember it?
No, I just don't have any positive... I no longer have any positive associations with the smell of alcohol.
Right.
You know, going on this tour right now, I was really scared. I really thought that I was, like, sticking my head in the lion's jaws, you know, because I'm out right now promoting a record that's all my old songs in praise of oblivion. You know, fuck right. the world and, like, bottoms up. And, you know, been playing and performing in a ton of dive bars and... You know, night after night, you know, emotionally damaged young men come up to me and are like, bro, that song where you're wasted, man, I love that song. You know, I got you this shot, you know, and then I have to say, I'm retired.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I haven't craved a drink once on this trip.
Yeah.
I'm tired. I'm so tired. I'm fried. I'm totally exhausted. I've been lonely, I've been angry, I cried, I gained 10 pounds from eating at Waffle House, now I have like a burgeoning gummy bear addiction that needs to be dealt with. Never once did I want to drink.
Yeah.
It's over, man.
How long has it been?
Creeping up on 6 years.
Mm-hmm. And, okay, talk to me about the mushrooms.
Yeah, let's talk about mushrooms.
So, but you still take mushrooms?
Absolutely.
How often?
Whenever I get the chance.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, and usually ends up being whatever, 3 or 4 times a year.
It's not that much.
No. Yeah, and that's the thing, which is, you know, that's, you know, I have a lot of different ways of facing down criticism of it, or saying that that's not sobriety. It, you know, which is anecdotally, how many mushroom addicts do you know?
Yeah, none.
When was the last time that you ate mushrooms, woke up the next morning, and were like, you know what I'd like right now? Some more mushrooms.
Right.
No, you're like, I'm never putting that disgusting donkey shit wood in my mouth ever again, you know?
I don't know if I woke up and said that, but yeah.
you said the Anna David version of that.
I think the Anna David version of that was like, that was super fun. I will definitely do it again, but I'm not making plans.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, you know, I will do it again, but not for a while.
Yeah.
Because I got enough.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And the, you know, personally, from, you know, from my experience, doing mushrooms is great because I have fun. Mm-hmm. And I think weird thoughts. And I think things that I wouldn't think otherwise. And I recall things that I wouldn't recall otherwise. And I always, the next morning, I have pages and pages of notes. Mm-hmm. And also, coming down sucks. It's unpleasant. And that's an important thing to remember, too. And that the process of coming down, I'm like, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I you know, I don't enjoy feeling like this. And it's enough of a callback to my old life that I'm like, oh, man, yeah, when I wake up tomorrow, I'm going running. And I gotta, like, burn all this out. And I usually, like, go through my phone and, like, delete 10 phone numbers because I'm like, I don't need these people in my life. They're not contributing to my life.
The people that you are doing shrooms with?
No, just other people who I'm like, you know, this is a friendship that I don't need to maintain. I don't need to be in touch with this person anymore. We were buddies at one point and, like, they don't make any positive contribution to my life. And
so, like, ayahuasca, like, it heals something.
I've never done ayahuasca, so I couldn't speak to that.
I could see you doing it, though.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, eventually I will.
Yeah.
I just got to find a way to do it without the, like, hippie attendance, because that...
Yeah, I don't know. At this point in time, it might be impossible to avoid that.
If I can do it without wearing moccasins, then then I'll do it. But then also, like, let's look at the science. 10 years ago, you know, marijuana was basically reefer madness. Mm-hmm. In the last 18 months, the last 2 years... You know, more and more hard empirical data is coming out showing that that there's a lot of benefits to medical marijuana. And there's absolutely risks as well.
Yes.
And I do think that, you know, there's a lot of people using medical marijuana who are just using it for kicks.
Yeah.
And
arguably, you know, more than are using it for the...
Yeah. You know, it's certainly not something that I'm, like, going to encourage my sister's kids to do. But we need to deal with, the war on drugs, whether it's an official war sponsored by a government or just the war on drugs in our brain, you know, that, oh, these things are evil, we need to keep them out of our lives. That needs to change. Mm-hmm. Not just human beings, but tons of different animals have a long relationship with intoxicants.
Mm-hmm. What are these other animals that have a long relationship?
There are deer that eat hallucinogenic mushrooms and then will even go and eat urine-drenched snow because the mushroom stuff is in that urine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they'll eat it. You know, and, like, monkeys eat fermented fruit and stuff like that. You know, there's, it plays a role. You know, and one of the things about mushrooms, you know, it's been proven, Johns Hopkins did a big study on, on mushrooms that shows that parts of your brain that ordinarily don't communicate with each other when you're taking mushrooms, they speak to each other, which is why you have things like you can smell a color, and, you know, 16 months after, you know, tripping in a controlled environment, people reported less depression, a greater sense of feeling connected, so lasting positive effects. And even in the 50s and 60s when they were experimenting with psilocybin and LSD, they found that it was an effective medicine for combating alcoholism. Well, Bill was on Belladonna when he had his big epiphany. You know, and I don't understand. It seems to me very puritanical that people are going to just sort of like, we need to throw this all out. It's all garbage. It all needs to go. You know, psilocybin and meth, they're not the same thing.
Right.
You know, and we need to understand that there are some things that have, you know, that have a positive, you know, can have a positive role in our lives.
But you do understand that there are people, and plenty of them, that any kind of alteration from, you know, of the mind would trigger them to...
Absolutely.
And, you know, and you sort of have the opposite, where the come down from mushrooms makes you sort of remember how much you don't want that. But I mean... The majority, I mean, I just know anecdotally from the people I know who then try it. And it's true, I can't say off the top of my head, I know people who are like sober and they're like, I'm going to go do shrooms. And then they went and had, you know, the wheels fell off the bus again. But you know, I think for a lot of people, and it's not better or worse, there's just no interest in it.
Well, here's another idea. If we classify marijuana as a forbidden substance, mm-hmm. and then somebody who's a sober alcoholic goes and takes one hit off a joint, and then they go back to drinking. Are they going back to drinking because the marijuana did something in their brain and reactivated something, or are they doing something, or do they go back to drinking because they rationalize to themselves, I've already done something forbidden. Right. I've already done something on the other side of the line. And that's why I'm going back, you know, and that's an excuse
right.
for me to go back to what I really want, which is alcohol.
Well, I'll tell you, I did have that experience, which was just that I drank, and then I did four and a half hits of ecstasy that night. And I consciously said, I drank... So why don't I just go full hog? Yeah. But I actually got sober the next day. Mm. So I don't know. But I had that. I the stories I hear from people are more, you know, I did it. And a lot of people who just made the conscious decision, who just said, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. I can do this. Or I don't like this program or whatever it is. And then the you know, progression, there's just a progression.
Yeah.
You know?
You know, I mean, I have to say this in every podcast, in every interview. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a scientist.
Right.
I'm not advancing that, you know, the stuff that I say, it's my opinion, you know, it's my opinions, and I generally phrase them as questions for a reason, because I am groping my way forward in my sobriety and trying to find my place in the universe and to try and make sense of my life and my past and stuff like that. But, you know, a 25-year-old dude wrote to me, and he was like, I'm drinking way too much. You know, I need to figure this out. You know, what do I do? You know, how do I cut back, or how do I cut down, or how do I stop, or whatever? And I told him, I said, if you need to make the evaluation if you're an alcoholic or not, if you're not an alcoholic, stop drinking immediately. Because right. if you're drinking too much, you'll become one.
Right.
If you're an alcoholic, you should keep drinking. Because if you're 25, you're probably not ready to quit. Ruin your life.
Right.
Go, you know, because my experience is it's very, very hard to quit until you're fucking desperate. And you'll do right. anything to, you know, to quit. And I really think I blew his mind.
Right.
Because he was like, you just told me the exact opposite of what I thought you were going to tell me.
Right.
And I was like, yeah, that's my role.
But I've also heard you say, I know I've heard you say, that you've told people who ask you, go to AA.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And part of that is, I do believe, I absolutely believe in, you know, the power of friends and friendship and a peer group, whether you're whether your illness is tuberculosis or cancer or alcoholism or sex addiction, having other people who are going through what you're going through to talk to is helpful if you've lost a child or right. if you're hooked on crack, you know, we know that. The other thing is that my story is remarkable because it's so different from the traditional narratives of how people get sober. And I don't have enough data to tell someone, yes, this is how you do what I did. I understand now that my story is different from other people's. And also, I'm a human being, and I'm a guy, like, just struggling to get my pants and my shoes on every morning.
Right.
And if you have 40 emails in your inbox of people, like, asking for help, nobody wants to go to AA.
No.
That is an excellent litmus test. If you are so desperate to quit drinking that you will even go to AA.
Yeah. The worst place on earth, the last place your mother or you wanted you to end up.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that's a great way for me to tell, there's this like demographic of like 59-year-old women who love to write to me after a couple glasses of wine.
Yeah, don't get that.
And talk about their drinking. And they don't want to stop drinking. They want fucking attention.
Yeah.
You know? And to tell somebody to go to AA is a great way to separate the people who want to get help from the people who want to fuck me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, to be fair, 100% of them could. And, you know, and I was going to say this. I was thinking about this. Like, the women I know you, we have so got to wrap up because it's over an hour and we don't go over an hour.
Okay.
But I do want to say this. Like, you know, whatever. It's a podcast. People can Google you really easily. But, you know, you do look the way that you look. And I feel like I am the one woman I know who knows you who thinks of your brain before the rest of it. Like, I do not. I feel like from the beginning, because we met over email and you were giving me advice about the Kindle singles and stuff like that. But yeah, I do know women who like mention your name and they go, they fucking lose it, dude. And I feel like I have no idea what you're talking about. Yeah, I know. Whatever. Worth saying, if only to pat myself on the back for my deep respect for you and your brain. But I do, okay, since we have to wrap up, we have to mention your books very briefly and tell people that if you want to hear more of this,
yeah,
in the written form, although also in the audio form, because I believe yes. they're on Audible. List your titles, please.
Shipwrecked is the first Kindle single I published. I got shipwrecked in 2001 and got rescued by the Coast Guard and still have the t-shirt to prove it.
Mm-hmm.
The Long Run is the sort of mini memoir of how I totally fucked up my life and then unfucked it. And how running was a tool that I used to maintain my sobriety and sort through the gulag of my past. Are You Lonesome Tonight is about a particularly committed stalker who I have, and it was an incredibly distressing episode of my life. Bachelor Number One, I had a reality TV show reach out to me to be on a dating show, and I really could not think of a worse person for that. Beat the Devil is about my experience chasing the rock and roll dream and how much havoc it wreaked on my life. And my last one was Of Mice and Me, which is the story of me adopting a tiny little newborn mouse and how it really made me, you know, forced me to come to terms with my own desire to not have children, my self-loathing, my relationship with my family, all that stuff. And I have a new record out called Coward's Path that just came out last week. A quote from Johnny Depp about the record.
What's his quote? What does he say?
He said, forever a favorite, sublime.
Great.
Which sounds just like Johnny Depp.
So, okay, just quick question, not to miss the point of all of those works which you need to buy. And I think you are the most, whatever, the most successful Kindle single author.
I have the most Kindle singles.
Right.
Stephen King and I were tied for number one, and then I got, and then I published my last one.
But quick question, is Zama still alive? Is Zama still with us? And you have a cat now, right? Is social media?
No, I have, it's like, my friends, when I come home from tour, they're like, yo, let me see your phone. I know you have, like, all kinds of titty pics.
Yeah.
No, man, I have pictures of cats and dogs.
Yeah, I know. Just like, it is in contrast to what one would
say. I don't have a pet, but I think about them often. As soon as I leave New York, I'm getting a dog. And we're going to have an awesome time together.
Oh, you guys are going to be hiking at Runyon Canyon, which is right down the street. So yes. There you go. Yeah. I will say, yeah, I almost texted you when I saw the picture of the cat, because that it looks just like my Lily. Uh-huh. But okay, so buy your books, buy your album. You're on tour until when?
I have another 10 days, and then I will be in England doing press for the record. And then I will be back out doing a West Coast run in from mid-May to early June.
It's all on your site.
Yes, mishkashabali.com.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank
fucking
you.
Delight. Awesome.
So that was Mishka Shubali, the author, the musician, the sober guy. Yeah, he calls himself sober. I call him sober. Yeah, why not? Yeah, great guy. Interesting guy. Go check him out. Go read his Kindle singles if you want to read the Kindle singles by the best-selling Kindle single author. And keep listening to this podcast and telling your friends and downloading and subscribing and reviewing if you're so inclined. So thank you. I miss you guys when we don't talk. I'll talk to you soon.